You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, October 22nd, 2014, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Guten Abend.
Guys, you all caught up with The Walking Dead?
No.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, good. So we can talk about it then.
No.
All right, here's
why.
How the last
I've been
ended.
Super busy, and also I'm very cheap, so I only just started the last season because it's free.
Wait, you only just started the previous season?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, a lot happens.
I know. Well, don't tell me.
All right, Rebecca, go away for 30 seconds.
We can't give spoilers anyway, so we have to talk about it without spoilers anyway.
Mm-hmm. You can make up shit.
Yeah, I'm here representing the audience that's screaming at you, no spoilers.
Right.
I like how they're making the zombies, you know, more decomposed and, you know, you can see time is going by because the zombies...
Has the power gone out yet?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Even more than that, I love when they walk by houses and the grass is like
mowed.
Not overgrown. It's kind of nice. Like, oh, come on, really?
Well, how long has it been?
Like
years.
A year and a half showtime. Like a year and a half to 2 years.
Oh, okay.
Showtime. So it hasn't been that long. But they, Jay, you're right. They are making a concerted effort to make it so that the zombies are obviously more decayed, missing noses. Things like that. So I do love those touches.
There are still new zombies being made, though, right?
Yeah.
True. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But not,
you know, they're way past the
peak. Yeah.
The big peak. Yeah.
They've passed peak zombie.
Yeah.
And so now their zombies are a dwindling commodity.
Yeah. And any good survival-based story, the real enemy out there are humans.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which is the case here.
What's funny, Rebecca, these people in the show this season, they start off in Buffalo and they go all the way
to San Francisco.
Yeah, to San Francisco. Mm. And they find out that it really sucks there. They just want
to
come back.
No, I bet they get there and they're like, wow, there's a ton of zombies, but the weather is gorgeous.
Yeah.
I know.
And also, the craft cocktail scene is amazing. That's probably what they said.
That is about as hipster as it gets, what you just said.
No, but the hairdressers charge about 50% more than
50% more. So. It's true. That's what I found.
Hipster zombies. They'll be more fun to kill.
That's right.
Hey,
oh, gotcha. There was
I'm right here.
That zombie is wearing Converse high tops. Kill him!
Are you kidding me? You're going to bust on my high tops now? You jerk. You know I love my rocket red high tops.
Yep.
Well, at least they're not wearing electronic wristwatches.
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up, Steve, because...
Oh, nice.
Today, you're never going to believe this. Like, what are the chances? But today, October 25th, the day that this episode goes out, back in 1960, the Accutron 214 was first made available for sale in New York by Bulova. And it was the world's first electronic wristwatch. It used a tuning fork for accuracy. And at the time it debuted, Bulova could brag that it was the most accurate wristwatch that had ever been created. And in fact, it was like the first big leap forward in timekeeping technology in several hundreds of years, really. It was kind of awesome looking. The first model that came out just looked like a regular watch, but then they had this test model that they would give to jewelers, and it had a clear face on it that showed the interior mechanism. And they realized that customers loved it. So they started selling that one as the Space View. And, the watch sold very well. It's, still got a cult following. You can find websites devoted to people trying to keep them up. However, unfortunately, the actual technology was made obsolete within the decade when another company debuted the quartz crystal, which was more accurate and cost a fraction of the cost to make. So the Accutron was finished by 1977. But yeah, like I said, people are still a bit gaga over it. Like watch nerds. That's a thing that exists. Watch nerds. I'm sure we'll get emails
sure.
from them.
Oh my gosh. And big time collectors.
Yeah. Big time collectors. That's good. I see what you did there. Yes. So yeah, it's a pretty cool, period. When reading up on it, it struck me that this was like one of the earliest objects that was starting to undergo that period of time where technology does become obsolete within the decade. It's like, oh, here's this amazing leap forward that hasn't occurred in hundreds of years. And then a decade later, it's like, whoops, sorry, nope.
What's funny is that, you know, basically people don't even wear watches anymore. You look Correct. Around. Most people aren't wearing a watch because, you know, you have so many other timekeeping devices on you.
Although Apple's trying to bring it back.
Fashion. With yeah. the it's a fashion accessory, yeah, which is really interesting. And the other watch as well. Who's releasing the other watch? Is it?
Well, there's
a few out there.
Yeah, there are other like Droid watches and
they're
stuff.
They're trying to appeal to a generation of people who haven't worn watches or anything on their wrists.
Yeah.
It's a really – and a small display and everything. And when displays are getting bigger and everyone's boasting about wanting more screen size and everything. So I find it odd.
See, I love it. I hate the idea of like the bigger screen size. I want something that I can carry with me without having to take along a purse to carry it in. And a smartwatch would be perfect for me. So I'm actually really excited for things going in that direction.
It's interesting. I'm very interested to see how that is going to go because like you can't really predict how consumers are going to respond to stuff like that until they actually try to use it. And it also may be that we need 5-10 years for that technology to mature a little bit. You know, it's like the earlier adopters of smartphones. I actually chose not to get one when they first came out because they just, you know, they weren't good enough. I had my laptop and I had my clamshell and that's all I needed. But now, of course, I wouldn't go anywhere without one. So you wonder if in 10 years, are we all going to be wearing smartwatches or is it going to be, you know, like
it's
the same?
Fad.
Yeah, they're going to remain a novelty item. I don't know.
And like Rebecca, for example, Rebecca, you like the idea of smartwatches and not having to carry a phone. But for at least for the short term and for most of these smartwatches, you're going to need to pair it with your smartphone to really have it do anything interesting.
Oh, yeah. No, so you're totally right. Yeah. I see this as more of a stepping stone, you know, to like the ultimate Dick Tracy watch. And, you know, if I have the extra money and I can afford to support something like that, then I probably will, you know, because I do want to encourage innovation in that way. But yeah, who knows? It might, you know, there's still like the Google Glass thing that's happening. Maybe that's the direction we'll go in. Or maybe we'll just have like magic contact lenses or something with heads-up displays.
You'll pair your watch, your smartwatch to your smart glasses.
There you go.
One of the other point is you mentioned that retro watches are still, you know, desirable for their fashion. There's actually a boutique, store in New Haven that sells, it's a watch piece of jewelry. It's not a watch. It doesn't function as a watch. It's just a piece of jewelry that's designed to look like a watch and it has all the gears and it's very retro, almost steampunk. You know, with its overworked gears, very pretty, but it's like
it does nothing.
But yeah, it's just the retro gear laden watch as a pure aesthetic, you know, piece of jewelry because nobody needs it as a watch. You know,
right? That's funny.
All right, well, let's get on with some news items. We have an interview coming up later in the show with David Gorski from Science Based Medicine. We're going to talk about kids with cancer, unfortunately, and we have a couple of other medical topics to talk about this week. This is a very Science Based Medicine heavy episode. I'm going to start off talking about a traditional Chinese medicine challenge. This is interesting. This is very much in the tradition of the James Randi Million Dollar Psychic Challenge.
Ooh.
This is a Chinese doctor who blogs under the pseudonym Ahbao, Ahbao. He's actually a burn care doctor in the Beijing hospital. And he is a science-based medicine-trained, you know, physician who, you know, believes in science and who is an outspoken critic of traditional Chinese medicine, which he calls fake science. And he has issued a challenge to proponents of TCM, traditional Chinese medicine, which relates to one of the primary aspects of TCM, which is the pulse analysis or pulse diagnosis. Have you guys ever heard of that before?
No.
I have not.
Yeah, it's interesting. So practitioners of TCM will like feel your pulse for minutes. They'll just sit with you and feel your pulse for 5 minutes or more and try to like really feel all the subtleties of the pulse. And they actually describe the pulse in many different ways, not only its rate and its strength, but is it hesitant or soggy or
soggy?
Soggy.
You know. That's a medical term?
This is how they describe the pulse. You know, all of these different features, is it, does it come up fast or is it short or long or delayed? Like all these subtleties of what the pulse feels like. And then they'll make a diagnosis based upon their very thorough, careful analysis of all of these features of the pulse. Now, of course, their diagnosis relates to the other major aspect of TCM, which is health is a matter of qi, the life energy, and being in balance of yin and yang. So if you have too much yin, your pulse will feel a certain way. Too much yang, it'll feel another way. If your qi is blocked, your pulse will be hesitant or whatever. You know, that's so the pulse diagnosis often relates to that. But sometimes they actually will also invoke this, you know, relates to the liver, you know, like that kind of thing. It's not like they feel your pulse and they go, you have type 2 diabetes. You know, they don't make it doesn't lead them to an actual disease diagnosis that would be recognized by a scientific practitioner.
So they get just a general sense that something is out of balance? Is that
just? My sense is it's a cold reading. Or maybe not even that. It's just, I consider it to be I agree with Bao, it's a completely fake system of pseudo-knowledge. Doesn't relate to anything real. Now, of course, the pulse, you know, scientific practitioners will feel the pulse and glean actual medical information from it. You know, we do feel the pulse to see, is it strong or weak? Is it fast or slow? Is it thready, et cetera? Is it equal in the right arm and the left arm? You know, are there specific pulses that are absent that may indicate a blockage? So yeah, we use the pulse to evaluate the cardiovascular system, you know, the thing that it's actually part of. That doesn't relate in some mysterious energy way to other aspects of health or the body. So it's possible that, you know, over the centuries, you know, TCM practitioners noticed that, really weak, rapid pulse is a bad thing. You know, sure, there may be some little bits of actual knowledge that have crossed over, but it's all embedded in this completely elaborate, like astrology-esque fake system of knowledge that has no basis in physiology or biology and is not evidence-based. It's never been demonstrated scientifically really in any way. So his challenge to TCM practitioners, because they claim, for example, he's pulled out now a specific claim, that they could establish whether or not a woman is pregnant by feeling their pulse. So he's okay.
Wow.
That's testable.
You get two pulses.
That's binary. That's good. It's not
and
like
helpful.
It's not like do you feel better? It's are you pregnant or not? Something that could be established objectively. So
most a little pregnant.
One person's already taken them up on the challenge and they're apparently negotiating the details of the protocol. There's already been a preliminary test, which I found out about after I blogged about it, but the preliminary test was just a few patients and the TCM practitioner failed. Could not identify who was pregnant. I think it was just 5 subjects, but they're going to do a larger test with 32 subjects. And in order to pass, the practitioner needs to be correct 80% of the time, which I think is actually fairly generous considering they say we could diagnose pregnancy. Okay. And this doctor, Bao, put the equivalent of about $8,000 as a reward for any practitioner who could do that. 50,000 yuan, or that comes out to about $8,000. And that's been matched by other donors who want to support his efforts. So now it's up to about 100,000 yuan or about $16,000. Yeah. So it's not the Randy Million, but, you know, it's starting to get to real money. So we'll see how that goes. It'll be very, very interesting. Now, of course, this isn't going to settle anything. You know what's going to happen. We all know what's going to happen, and it's already starting to happen, is the excuses of why it's not working.
Bad skeptic energy.
Well, here's the thing. So even though they say that they could feel the pulse and use that to diagnose pregnancy, it's part of an overall assessment. They have to smell and look at and interact with the patient. And so in this case, in the study, you know, there's lots of actual physiological cues. I mean, have you ever seen a woman that you've known and like you knew they were pregnant just by the way they looked?
Yes.
You know? Yeah. I mean, even before they're showing.
Yeah.
It could change your complexion. You know, there are some outward effects. So in the study protocol, the practitioner is blindfolded and they can feel, I guess they could still smell, but then they feel the pulse, but they're blindfolded so they can't see the patient and decide based upon visual cues if they're pregnant or not. So now, of course, that is the setup for excuses. Well, that's not typically what we do. Typically, I could see the patient as well as feel their pulse, et cetera. So that'll be the special pleading when it fails. Have you guys ever heard of urine diagnosis?
Oh, sure. Sure. Do they drink it?
I think so.
Or I assume this isn't just like peeing on the stick that you get at CVS.
No, Rebecca, they make like those drinks in San Francisco out of it.
What, you know what, Jay? Get over it, okay?
You're wearing a jacket. She's out there.
Yeah, I am on the beach, and yeah, you are about to get a nor'easter. Deal with it.
We're talking about medieval doctors like Theodoric of York. You guys remember him, right?
I love him.
Theodoric of York.
So Theodoric practiced Galenic medicine. You know, Galen was...
Yeah.
The four humors, you know, blood and bile.
Turns out it wasn't that funny, though.
That's right.
Good one.
And
sorry.
So this is the exact analog to what I just described in TCM. In TCM, they use this elaborate system of the qualities of the pulse, which are mostly subjective and fictitious, although, you know, some actual real aspects like how fast is it. And they use that to diagnose fictitious problems with a non-existent qi, yin and yang. In Europe, if you were Theodoric, then you would look at urine, and they had these elaborate charts with all these subtle different hues and colors of the urine. And then also you would smell it and maybe even taste it. And they would use that to diagnose, like, which humor was out of balance. You know, so again, it related to their philosophy of humoral medicine. It's the exact analogy, except in the West, you know, the Galenic medicine and urine diagnosis, also called piss prophet. So that's kind of a modern joke. That was replaced with scientific medicine and no longer is, you know, culturally still supported. But isn't that interesting? So you have these systems, these elaborate systems that were practiced for centuries, a couple of thousand years, you know. It's pretend knowledge. It's fake knowledge. It's an elaborate system, which I find fascinating. And I think it relates, it's a good microcosm. It's a good study of what happens when you don't do science, right? When your system of belief is disconnected from any self-correcting empirical system that you're testing against reality. Absent that, then you can come to believe anything is true. So imagine how powerful the confirmation bias would be. So you're a student, you learn about the urine charts or the pulse diagnosis from an expert who's been doing it for years. And, you know, he tells you, yeah, if the piss looks this color, that means that you need to bleed them for 5 minutes. And you do it and the person gets better and then validates the whole system in your mind. And if the patient died, there's some special pleading reason why they died. They didn't come to you early enough or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the systems tend to get more creative and more elaborate over time. It is just like astrology, right? Astrology is sort of that's the quintessential for skeptics, the elaborate system of fake knowledge. People go through charts and all kinds of elaborate things, but it has absolutely no relationship to reality. That's the same thing with traditional Chinese medicine. You know, yeah, there may be an herb in there that really does make you go to the bathroom or whatever, something obvious and basic, but largely their ministrations are completely disconnected from reality. Okay, let's move on. Jay, you're going to take the lead on the next medical topic, which is amazingly a treatment for spinal cord paralysis.
That's right, Steve. You've probably heard about this. There are British doctors at the University College London, and they developed of course there's doctors at the hospital. They've developed an incredible technique that restores, Bob, this is very dramatic, a severed spine. Can you believe it?
No, not at this point.
Surgeons in the Polish city of Wrocław have implanted regenerative cells that regrew the spinal tissue of an injured firefighter who was paralyzed. He was paralyzed from the chest down from a knife attack, apparently, when he was on the job. He was attacked and the knife, you know, just literally just cut his spine open and he had significant damage. The patient is now reporting after the treatment that he has sensation in his legs and can control his leg muscles. And this is the first time this has ever been accomplished. A severed spine has always been the impossible injury to fix.
Well, in a human.
In a human. Many researchers have tried over the decades to develop a way to restore it, and no one has successfully done it until this collection of doctors at different hospitals. So the doctors used a special human cell called the olfactory and sheathing cells, or OECs, and these are harvested from the patient, nose actually, and they typically repair nasal nerves that were damaged, which, you know, might not be as uncommon as you think. And that's probably why those cells are in place to help restore damaged nasal nerves. These cells have been proven to enable spinal nerve fibers to regrow, and they will regrow nerve connections that were once severed. The patient, Derek Fidka, had an 8-millimeter gap in his spinal cord, which is not insignificant. And the injury was sustained in 2010, and it, like I said, it was from a knife wound that sliced him clean open. And at the time, his doctors gave him less than a 1% chance of having any mild recovery. And when I say mild recovery, that means, you know, probably just some type of sensation and most likely no muscle control. The OEC implants over time slowly restored the connection between Derek's nerve fibers, Bob. He regained sensation.
How?
I think I kind of already said it, but I'll keep going. He first regained that sensation, and then later he started to develop some muscle control, and 10 months after the surgery, he was able to walk with braces inside the walking frame that they have in hospitals. You've probably seen video of people using those.
So, Jay, I'll add a little bit more detail to answer Bob's question. They actually took a graft of nerves, and they used that to bridge the gap. So it wasn't just the olfactory stem cells. And then, so they had basically using these nerves as like a scaffold,
right,
to bridge the gap. And then you put the stem cells on either side and hope that they'll grow along the grafted nervous tissue and reconnect. And then to some degree, they did.
That's right. Yeah.
This can't be the first time that they've tried that.
This is the first, I think, human study. It's been done in rats before.
Yeah, but Bob, it's the first successful time they've done it in a human with those cells.
Okay. Wow.
Professor Joffrey Raisman, the head of UCL's Institute of Neurology, who conducted this groundbreaking research into OECs, said, "I believe we have now opened the door to a treatment of spinal cord injury, which will get patients out of wheelchairs. Our goal is to develop the first procedure to a point where it can be rolled out as a worldwide general approach." So, he discovered that during his research onto the olfactory and sheathing cells, that damaged nasal nerves that enter the olfactory bulbs will regrow. So he observed this, restoring a person's sense of smell. So he figured, okay, hey, that this is happening here. You know, it's the person's own cells. Let's start testing. So he also stated that we believe that in procedure in the breakthrough, which as it is further developed, will result in a historic change in the currently hopeless outlook for people disabled by spinal cord injury.
Holy crap.
Yep.
That's amazing.
That's fantastic.
Wow.
And I heard that they're looking for more people now.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Over the years, I've heard, you know, yeah, cure spinal cord, blah, blah, blah. And my initial reaction is always, you know, skepticism. It's like, okay, let's see what's actually happening here. You know, the news reports are almost certainly going to be overhyped and not accurate. But, you know, when I read this study, this one actually is legitimate. But it is being overhyped in the press. Some of the headlines like patients walking again, et cetera, but making it seem as if the recovery is greater than it was. So first of all, there were 3 patients in the study who got the transplant. This is just the most improved of the 3. One of the patients had essentially no improvement in motor strength. The second had a little bit, and this patient had a more significant, but still not anywhere near normal. There were 3 basic outcomes: strength, sensation, and spasticity. You know, so actually, as the reconnections get made, the spasticity decreases as well. And
what is that? What is spasticity?
Spasticity is the muscles are contracting involuntarily because the signals from the brain actually inhibit the lower motor neurons, the motor neurons that connect to the muscles. So without that tonic inhibition, the muscles go into contraction. And so this is restoring some of that inhibition, reducing that spasticity, reducing those involuntary contractions. And that's huge for symptom relief, quality of life, and functionality. That's huge. It didn't completely relieve it, but it reduced it, you know, again, to varying degrees in the different patients. So a little bit of reduction in spasticity, a little bit of sensation, a little bit of increased strength, you know, to varying degrees in the three patients. So that's very encouraging. That's all huge. But it's not like they didn't go from being totally paralyzed to like normally walking. So I just want to make sure you don't get the wrong idea.
Well, yeah, it took a long time for the healing process to happen.
And it took a couple years. This is like after 2 years. And also they had controls where they just gave them the same rehab program but didn't do the transplant, and none of them got better. So that was good. They had actually good controls.
Okay. Yeah, but Steve, 2 years – over that time, won't your muscle have wasted away to a significant degree in that time?
Depending on the location of the injury, you have different kinds of muscle atrophy. When you have a peripheral lesion, so essentially, sorry for the neuroanatomy lesson, but essentially there are two motor neurons that control your muscles. The upper motor neuron, which goes from your brain to your spinal cord, and the lower motor neuron, which goes from your spinal cord to your muscle. That's it. It's a two-neuron system. You know, you have one neuron, one axon goes all the way from your brain all the way down to the bottom of your spinal cord.
And that's one cell, right? That's one neuron.
Cell. Yeah, it's one cell. And then there are interneurons that modulate this, but basically the electrical connection is two neurons. If you damage that upper motor neuron from the brain to the spinal cord, then you get spasticity. If you damage the lower motor neuron, then you get the really severe atrophy, because the lower motor neuron, that's the one that secretes hormones that keeps the muscle fibers alive and healthy. If you lose that, your muscles waste away. So with a spinal cord injury, you get both. You get lower motor neurons at the level of the lesion, because that's where the lower motor neurons are. They're in the spinal cord. But you're also taking out the upper motor neuron axons for everything below that. So that's why typically you'll get spasticity in the legs. You know, pretty much anywhere in the spinal cord you have a lesion, you know, the legs are going to be below it because they're at the bottom of the spinal cord. Now, you don't get a lot of atrophy with the upper motor neuron lesion. You get disuse atrophy. You get a little bit of atrophy, you know, atrophy, but you don't get that total wasting away that you're thinking of, Bob. Because the lower motor neurons are still intact. You get spasticity is what you get.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So yeah, awesome. So the muscles are not totally gone. They will definitely be wasted by disuse, no question. But they won't be the totally withered limbs that you see like from polio, which is a lower motor neuron disease. They wither away because it's a lower motor neuron disease.
And Steve, when you say wither away, I mean, it's essentially there's no coming back. I mean, that's like the muscle is almost not even there anymore, right?
Yeah. So the muscle fibers themselves will survive at most for about 18 months without nerve supply.
Steve, I have a question about that though. If any muscle is left, could you regain your muscles the way you had them?
It'll never get back to normal, but one good thing is, yes, any muscles that are still there can be reinnervated. They get their nerve supply back. They'll function. If you have some healthy muscles and some muscles that have lost their nerve supply, the healthy nerves will actually send off little sprouts, cross sprouting, and they'll pick up the denervated muscle fibers. A partial lesion has a much better prognosis than a complete lesion. Like he had a complete transection. The entire cord was transected. So he didn't have any of this cross sprouting. Once this treatment becomes established, if you could get to people quickly and, you know, maybe by the time, let's say after the acute injury, the dust is settled on the acute injury a couple of months down the road, we pretty much know what the state of their spinal cord is. The swelling has gone away, etc. Then they get the transplant, they could actually already start to have some reconnections before that 18 months is up. You know what I mean?
Is there any way to mimic the effect the intervention has so that you could maintain it beyond that window?
Not for lack of trying. Bottom line, no. Right now, we don't have any technological substitute for that nerve supply. We've tried, you know, injecting hormones, giving hormones, electrical stimulation. They maybe help a little bit, but it does not replace having a nerve connected to the muscle fiber. So far that's really the only treatment is to regenerate that nerve. So very cool. I will also one last note before we move on. At the end of the article about it, the researcher said, "This information is being made available to researchers around the world so that together we can fight to finally find a cure for this condition, which robs people of their lives." That contrast that to the, "You have to come to my special clinic in China because we're the only ones who will cure you." right? The fake treatments always want you to come to their special clinic that nobody else does what they do. The real research, like, here it is. We're publishing it. It's like, let's do it. It's making it available to the world. I just wanted to point that out.
Good contrast.
Evan, you're going to tell us about the Giants of Arkansas, which they are not, it turns out, a baseball team.
That's right, or a football team.
Yeah. I would have guessed.
No, the New York Giants have not moved to Arkansas. No. No, this story is huge, right? This could be the largest human interest story we've ever talked about. A recent news headline out of Arkansas. Here's how it reads. Diver finds evidence showing Giants lived in Arkansas. Now, there's one major problem with this headline. There's no evidence that a diver found any evidence of Giants who lived in a lake in what we know now as Arkansas. But other than that, the headline's perfectly accurate. This diver believes that Giants once existed, like many people do. Well,
where did he get that idea?
sort of who have perhaps a religious disposition for, you know, the Bible being entirely accurate, and it talks about Giants and certain things. But so he believes it, and he went down, and Arkansas has a bit of a history that dates back, you know, about 150 years of some stories emanating from that area about these sorts of things. And he went to search for himself, and he said what he found down there at the bottom of the lake was a wall that was obviously man-made, and the cave also had a flowing spring in it, which would have been an ideal shelter, the diver said. No remains or anything were found, obviously, or any other, you know, patently scientific evidence.
Yeah. Or otherwise you wouldn't be hearing about it first here. Yeah.
His interpretation of it. Now, this leads actually into something a little bit larger. A few weeks ago, I'm channel surfing the television, and there's the Never Reliable History Channel. A commercial comes up for a new show that they're going to be presenting in November. You hear a person say, "There are giant skeletons reported all over this area. We're going to get to the bottom of it no matter what. It may sound like science fiction, but I believe in giants." And the show is called Search for the Lost Giants.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a quick little piece of the description from the History Channel website about the show. Stonemasons Jim and Bill Vieira are on a quest to investigate an incredible theory that the myths and legends we've all been told about giants are actually rooted in fact. Jim has researched over 1,000 accounts of skeletons 7 feet tall or over and unearthed across America in the 19th and 20th centuries. Search for Lost Giants will follow the Vieira brothers on their quest to find evidence of these missing bones, which seem to have slipped through the hands of history, and so on. And Jim Vieira was invited to give a talk at TEDx. And his talk is titled Stone Builders, Mound Builders, and the Giants of Ancient America. And they came down hard on both the TEDx organizers for allowing this person to get up there and talk, and even harder on Jim Vieira for promoting his pseudoscience. And so TEDx was forced to write a letter to Jim explaining why they had to dump him. From the letter, it reads, "Ted's fact check found that your talk is based on a debunked popular hoax from the early 1900s and promotes a well-known and widely discredited fringe theory while misrepresenting the existence of legitimate research on this issue."
Snap.
Yeah. And they give him a few specific examples of his unsubstantiated claims. And there are a lot of them, but I'll just mention, you know, two of them, two simple ones. You mentioned carbon dating, but do not specify what was carbon dated. You cannot carbon date stone.
Mm-hmm.
And you share newspaper clippings from the 19th century, including quotes from Abraham Lincoln, and claim they are evidence of giants. In fact, as one of our experts writes, skeletal hoaxes were common in the 19th century, such as Piltdown Man, the Cardiff Giant, Barnum and Bailey's Fiji Mermaids, and so forth.
They're constantly, all of these channels are constantly trying new show ideas and see which ones stick. Mm-hmm. I mean, who would have thought that Duck Dynasty was going to be a multi-million dollar earner, you know?
Yeah, another show, searching for something we're never going to find because it doesn't exist. That's basically the format.
Yeah, we'll wrap it up with a quote from Kenny Fader, and he says, "I've been digging for 30 years. I've never found the bones of a giant human being ever. It's easy to silence the skeptics like me by producing the skeletons." Thank you very much, Kenny.
Do it. I mean, we'd love to see
one
it. Sure.
Bone.
It'd be cool.
Bring it on.
Well, Evan, it's time for Who's That Noisy?
Thanks, Steve. I'm going to play for you last week's Noisy, a voice I think many of us are familiar with. And here's a reminder.
There is a rumor that was in U.S. News and World Report a number of months ago that Jimmy Carter might make make some unsettling disclosures about the UFO phenomena sometime in December.
And he did. Well, sort of. I wouldn't call it unsettling, but Jimmy Carter saw a UFO.
I was not unsettled.
Nah, I wasn't unsettled at all. But how about that voice? And who would be talking like that around the Jimmy Carter era? Let's see, what movie about UFOs that kind of changed the culture came out around the time of the late 70s? Well, that's right, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. That was none other than Steven Spielberg. Tremendous, tremendous, one of my all-time favorite movie directors, and also a believer in all sorts of crazy nonsense. Damn shame.
Did anybody get that?
Yeah, several people did. There's only ever one winner per week. William Cassell. C-A-S-S-E-L-L. So well done, William. You're this week's winner. You go into the year-end pool. If we draw your name then, you're going to join us in early 2015 for an episode of Science
Join Origin. Us.
Join us. Become part Good of the job. Collective.
Okay. And what do you got for this week, Evan?
All right. For this week, another voice.
This is a new and strange environment at first. This suddenly finding yourself in orbit.
That should, I think the clue itself narrows it down quite sufficiently.
Yeah.
Send your guess to WTN@theskepticsguide.org. That is the official email for Who's That Noisy? Or post it on our message boards, on our forums, sguforums.com. Good luck, everyone.
Thanks, Evan. Well, we have a couple of emails this week. These are both follow-ups of previous stories. The first one comes from Aaron from Cleveland, Ohio, and Aaron writes, I know you talked about the Bicep 2 result regarding cosmic inflation and gravity waves some time ago, which was touted as an extremely important result for our understanding of cosmology. But so far as I'm aware, you haven't discussed the follow-up to that story that came with some new Planck satellite data regarding dust in the Milky Way. He goes on a bit more, but that's basically his question. So, Bob, did you get up to date onto this?
Well, first, we had to do a little bit of background. I talked about this earlier this year, what seemed to be solid evidence for cosmic inflation. That's a theorized event in the early universe that exponentially expanded the universe. And it's such a useful theory that it pretty much explained away a whole host of anomalies in the universe, such as homogeneity and the flatness problem. It did away with those in one fell swoop. So inflation seems pretty solid. But proving that it actually happened is very tough. But it may have left an imprint on the first light that the universe emitted a quarter million years after the Big Bang. Inflation would have caused gravitation waves when it was happening that would have essentially polarized the CMB in a very specific way. Specifically, it's called the B-mode polarization, and that just means that the magnetic and electric fields that make up the CMB would have this special twisted or curling pattern. And that's exactly what the scientists claim that they found. The twisted light from the CMB, which was caused by the gravitational waves, which were in turn created by the cosmic inflation, which happened right after the Big Bang, which happened right after, well, who the hell knows what happened, before that. But so that's pretty much the chain, connection, there. So the Planck collaboration did a study. They were skeptical. They found out that the patch of sky that the original study looked at had an unusually large amount of dust. In our galaxy that contaminated the results, essentially. This dust emits this twisted polarized light that's similar enough to the twisted CMB light to be mistaken for it. And so the collaboration also identified other deficiencies in the experimental design that led to that prediction that wasn't warranted. So the bottom line then is that the measurements that the Bicep 2 made were solid, but the claim that they had great evidence for cosmic inflation though was very premature and irresponsible to go there. So the next step is going to be the two teams are actually going to combine forces and they're going to combine all their data and maybe make some more measurements and hopefully they can still tease out of the evidence for inflation. So that's a best case scenario and we may know that before the end of the year. If that doesn't work, they may need to schedule some more dedicated satellite missions to get the necessary sensitivity and data. So keep your fingers crossed. We may still yet have solid confirmation that inflation and gravitational waves exist, and therefore inflation.
Science is a cruel mistress. Darn evidence.
Yeah, it's cool though. It's cool. It's a very huge story and it's going through peer review. It's, you know, the scientific community is picking it over and it's like, wait a minute. Maybe this is not quite right. And then they're going to collaborate, go take a look. I mean, this is science in action. These stories are great. Okay. The next follow up, I'm not going to read any specific email. We got lots of links to a follow up story about the Jack the Ripper story that we did a little while ago. So if you recall, researchers claimed that they had the bloody shawl from one of the Ripper's last victims, and it was unwashed for a century. And, you know, he has this artifact and was able to extract mitochondrial DNA, and he tested the mitochondrial DNA, and it matched the living descendant of one of the suspects of who Jack the Ripper was, named Aaron Kosminski. Now, this report was met with skepticism on multiple levels, including when we discussed it. You know, we're not really sure of the provenance of that shawl. And even if Kosminski's DNA got on it somehow, it doesn't necessarily mean that he was Jack the Ripper, since he was frequenting prostitutes at that time in that area. This research was never peer-reviewed. It was revealed in a book. Since it's been out, experts have been poring over some of the details, doing the kind of thing that would have happened if it were peer reviewed in the first place. So this is one of the reasons why we pay attention to whether or not data has been peer reviewed, because there are just little technical details that the experts have to pore over to make sure they're correct. And unless it passes at least that minimum threshold, you just never know if the results are reliable or if there are major problems. So in this case, the DNA analysis was done by a Dr. Luhalainen. I think I'm getting that reasonably correct. Since then, it was actually bloggers, you know, poring over the data who were familiar with the specific mitochondrial DNA database that Luhalainen used in the research. And they figured out that Luhalainen made a technical error. He actually made a nomenclature error. So he incorrectly called the type of mitochondrial mutation that was matched between Kosminski and his descendant. He wrote it as 314.1C, but actually he should have written it as 315.1C, a slight error, but with huge implications. The mutation that Luhalainen thought he was dealing with is only present in one out of every 290,000 people, and therefore a match is highly significant. The mutation that it actually was, however, is present in over 90% of Europeans. And so the match means nothing. So you went from a highly specific match to 90% of Europeans have this mutation, and therefore a match literally means nothing. So that one little tiny nomenclature mistake completely erases the significance of the mitochondrial DNA evidence that was being presented. So it's gone. This line of evidence is basically destroyed. So we still don't know who Jack the Ripper was.
Well, yeah, of all of the mistakes that I think a lot of us assumed that they were making, that was not one of them. So kudos to them for coming up with a novel mistake.
Oh, it's highly technical. How the hell would I know? Like 315.1C versus 3. That's the kind of thing where you need an expert in that very tiny area, somebody familiar with the mitochondrial DNA database.
A peer, if you will.
A peer, exactly. To review, make sure that there's no mistakes like that are being made, you know. Exactly. So this is why we are skeptical of non-peer-reviewed but highly technical evidence. Okay, so thanks to everybody who wrote in to alert us to that, and glad we were able to provide the follow-up.
Steve, we got a lot of stuff coming up.
Yeah, I know. We have our big Down Under SGU George Rabb tour. We're going to be going to California and then Australia and then New Zealand. It's a ton of work, but it's going to be worth it. We're really looking forward to it.
Here's what you should do. If you're interested, you should take a look at our schedule.
It's a lot of details. So if you want to see if any of these events are going to be available to you, go to the skepticsguide.org website, go to the science news section, and there is an entry called SGU Down Under. Skeptical Extravaganza is the banner. I'll keep that bumped towards the top of the news item so it'll be easy to find. I'm just going to run through what we're doing very quickly. Ready? November 22nd, Saturday, 2:30 to 4 in Fremont, California at Ohlone College. We're doing our brand new, newly developed Skeptical Extravaganza and quiz show. Jay, tell them a little bit about that.
Well, it really starts with the quiz show, which is us fighting against the audience. The audience tries to beat the SGU during this quiz show. But since TAM of this year, we've continued to develop this, and we've turned it into a lot of other different things that are going to come before and after the quiz show. So we're not going to reveal too much, but you know, we have a bunch of different skits and things going on, and George is hosting it. It's going to be a lot of fun, really crazy stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of experimental, but I think it's going to be fun. All right, then we go to Australia, November 25th, Tuesday evening in Canberra at the Finkel Lecture Theatre. We have a Q&A with George and with the SGU, and then after that, at King O'Malley's Irish Pub, George Robb is going to play some music. And then on Wednesday evening, we're having a private dinner just for those people who want to help sponsor the trip. So if you're interested in significantly sponsoring the trip, then contact us directly by email, and I'll discuss with you the details of that. Then we have the Australia National Skeptics Convention. That will be Friday to Sunday, November 28th to 30th. And then on that Friday, we're doing the SGU Geo Skeptical Extravaganza and Quiz Show again. We have live shows at the conference, a private recording at the conference. Then on Monday, December 1st, we fly to Wellington, New Zealand, and we'll have a private dinner with the SGU and George and some local skeptics there that might be sold out, but there'll be a link available if you want to, you know, see if you can get your way into that as well. And then that weekend, so now we're talking Friday, December 5th, we're doing the Skeptical Extravaganza for a third time, and then the 6th and 7th is the New Zealand Skeptical Conference, where we're doing, again, a live show and a private recording. And there'll be other, you know, obviously we'll be appearing at other lectures and stuff there during those conferences as well. And as usual, we make ourselves as available as we can to our listeners, try to get as much face time as we can.
So please do take a look at our schedule, and we'd love to see you at any one of these events.
Yep. And George Tribe will be with us the whole way, adding his music and his unique stylings. Can we call them stylings?
You could, Steve, but
I don't think... Is that too cliche?
It's, you know, look, it's George and his thing. He's got an awesome
thing.
We love George, and it's how awesome is it that he's going to be with us on this whole thing?
You mix that with the SGU, it's like chocolate and peanut butter, right?
I'd like to think of it that way.
Okay. All right, thanks, Jay. Let's get back to the rest of the show. Joining me now is David Gorski. David, welcome back to the Skeptic's Guide.
Hey, it's great to be back.
It's been a little while, I think, since we've had you on, huh?
Not as long as between the last two.
Yeah.
See, we're getting better.
Well, we always have so much to talk about. I wanted to bring you on this week about a specific item. There's a couple of news items about, again, more kids dying of cancer because their parents want to give them alternative treatments, which we'll get to in a moment. But then I was like, oh, there's like these dozen other things we could chat about while we got you on. The first thing I wanted to talk about is the Society for Science-Based Medicine, of which you are the chairman of the board.
Indeed. And Mark Crislip is the president. You're on the board. Everybody's, you're the vice president.
Yeah, so I take over if Mark gets killed in a horrible accident somehow.
And you have a tie-breaking vote in the Senate.
And I know we mentioned it on the show before, but might as well take this opportunity to say it again. So this is a nonprofit, membership-driven organization dedicated to the promotion of science in medicine, sfsbm.org. So go there, check it out. You could become a member. You could either just sign up, or you could actually become a dues-paying member and help support the society and everything that we do.
Right. Go. Join. help. Help us in our
mission.
We definitely
need all the help we can get. So, David, you are an oncologist, for those who may not know. You are one of course, the authors at Science-Based Medicine and the managing editor. So you do a lot of the heavy lifting for me running that website. And one of the topics that you write frequently on Science-Based Medicine about is the balance of rights and the responsibilities of the state and the rights of the parents when you have a child, so, you know, underage patient who has cancer, and the parents decide that they don't want to listen to the recommendations of their physicians.
Yeah, this is something, you know, I first started the original blog before Science Based Medicine back in 2004, and it didn't take me long to start encountering these cases. And over the last 9 years, I've written about several of them. They keep popping up, and it's incredibly depressing. The latest one, for me anyway, is a young Amish girl you may have heard about last year. Mm-hmm. By the name of Sarah Hershberger, you know, whose parents started to give her chemotherapy because, contrary to what a lot of people think, the Amish actually do use modern science-based medicine. But then they balked, and after a couple of rounds, they basically stopped it. This is the sort of thing that happens because, you know, it's easy to say, oh, what are these parents are morons. You know, they're not, no, most of them aren't. What happens a lot of the time is they see their kid suffering because chemotherapy's rough, let's face it, especially if you're a kid and you can't really understand why it's necessary. The parents sometimes just freak, you know. It's and especially ones who are prone to, you know, some, you know, this alternative medicine type thinking anyway. They're very susceptible to the message that, you know, these horrible toxins are going to do more harm than good. And, you know, let's face it, chemotherapy is toxic. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, I mean, I make it a point to say, you know, I don't blame the parents in cases like this. I mean, you have to be totally understanding about, you know, having a terminally, very seriously ill child and then seeing them very ill from the chemotherapy the doctors are giving them. That's a very rough position to be in. So I'm never judgmental of the parents. Doesn't mean I agree with their decision making. I think they can make very poor decisions. But I feel the real, you know, if there is a villain in this saga, it's the alternative medicine proponents who are luring them away with false promises by telling them, don't take that, you know, poison, don't trust your doctors. Right, yeah. We have the magic solution that will cure their cancer without side effects.
Right. And, you know, it is a very, and here's the other thing about childhood cancer, that, you know, childhood cancer is one of the truest success stories of science-based medicine. If you look at the mortality from childhood cancer in like 40 years ago, 50 years ago, it was astronomical, you know, like close to 100%. And then through experimentation, development of chemotherapy, development of these regimens, a lot of these cancers are 90%+ curable. Some of them not as good, you know, but they're all, most of them are quite treatable except for the pediatric brain tumors, which is another issue entirely. But they require really long courses of chemotherapy, a lot of them, especially the hematologic malignancies like the lymphomas and the leukemias. For instance, Sarah Hershberger, they were recommending a 27-month course of chemotherapy. Oh. Now, wow. We don't do this because we like to torture children. You know, we do this because we found out, you know, decades ago that if you stop too early, the cancer comes back. And over time, through this kind of empiricism, they came up with all these regimens, and there are all these stages like induction chemotherapy, consolidation chemotherapy, you know, maintenance, and all these other, you know, there can be up to 5 or 6 different distinct, you know, steps in the chemotherapy regimen, and it can take a couple of years. And so here's what happens. Here's a common story. The parents see that the tumor is going away. You know, like, let's say after 1 or 2 courses of chemotherapy, man, you got a great response. The tumor appears to be gone. So they think, why do they need these months and months of more chemotherapy? And it's hard to explain or convince them of this sometimes, you know, depending on their worldview.
Yeah, so it's sort of in what we call the honeymoon phase, you know, where the initial treatment's over, the patient could look cancer-free, look fine, and the purpose of all the rest of the chemotherapy is to keep it from coming back, and so it's easy to convince themselves at that point they don't need it.
Right, and, you know, and that's what happened with Sarah Hershberger, although I don't think her tumor was completely gone. She got, I believe, if my memory serves, 2 courses of chemotherapy over a couple, you know, like maybe 3 months. And she got started to get really sick with the second one. And at some point, one of the nurses coming to her house said something that set the parents off. I think she said something about this stuff being poison and having to be, you know, disposed of as toxic waste, which, well, you know, some of it does. And I think that set the parents off. Now, here's another common thing about these stories is, you know, when they've either one of two things will happen or both. They'll often go to court, you know, Child Protective Services will get called in, you know, for medical neglect. They'll go to court. If the parents lose, then they frequently will flee, or, you know, and this, I've seen this happen several times.
They'll flee the country.
They'll flee wherever, you know. Hirschberger, it's not entirely clear where she went. I think she went to Central America. I've seen others go to Mexico, you know, various places.
Right, but sometimes the courts do not decide to require that the children get standard science-based medicine. They allow the parents to refuse to give them chemotherapy or whatever the standard treatment is.
Based on what?
It's not sometimes. It's a lot.
It's a lot of the times, yeah. Which is shocking that basically they're affirming the parents' right to medically neglect their children because they feel like it, you know, for philosophical reasons, basically.
Well, in this country, there is this, it's not just this country, but it seems stronger in this country than a lot of places, this idea that the children, like that the parents have like absolute power over the children, like the children are like, they're almost like their possessions, you know, and that the state has no right to tell me how to take care of the child. The problem is that thinking leaves out one person, the child, you know, it's like.
At the end of the day, it's always the child that dies or that suffers.
I understand that it's difficult. You know, if the parents aren't cooperative, a lot of these regimens, if the parents aren't cooperative, then you got to take the kid away from the parents because you need someone who's going to make sure the child gets to appointments, gets the chemotherapy on time, is monitored for, you know, side effects and adverse reactions. I also understand, for instance, when the child gets to be a bit older, like if we're talking about teenager, you start getting into some real gray areas as far as, you know, autonomy.
Yeah.
I can understand why the parents might feel that they're being quote unquote bullied, because this is another complaint that you hear time and time again. But if you look at it from the pediatric oncologist's perspective, they have a child here that they can save, and the parents are saying, "No, you can't give them the treatment that can save this child." So you might get pushier and pushier, and you know, to try to get them to let the child be treated. I can totally understand that. It's hard to. It would be hard not to. I mean, think of it. If you're trying to put yourself in the doctor's place, you know, you might get kind of pushy and obnoxious to save the child.
The child is their patient.
Exactly. The parents are not.
They're ethically obligated to do everything they can to give the medical care they feel that their patient needs. Yeah, they're almost obligated to be pushy. So, David, there are a couple of recent cases I want to talk about quickly that have some interesting wrinkles to them. The first one comes from Western Australia, a 10-year-old girl, Tamara Stitt, who actually recently died from liver cancer, who it was thought was probably curable if her parents had allowed her to receive standard treatment.
I had heard about it somewhat recently because they had a court case about it, as I recall.
The one thing that I thought was interesting was in the court testimony, the mother testified that she believed there was a 100% chance that her daughter would be cured with natural therapies. Those natural therapies included clay wraps, vitamins, and supplements, basically.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I mean, I looked at the case. It's a hepatoblastoma, which is a liver cancer. And, you know, the treatment is chemotherapy and surgery. I think for her case, what I saw quoted was about a 60% chance of survival with conventional therapy. So it's not one of the pediatric tumors that we're doing as fantastic with, but it's still quite reasonable chance if you go for it. You know, as much as I sympathize with the parents, I sympathize with the child even more because, you know, it's a horrible situation, and some parents just, you know, have a hard time dealing with it and I understand that, but that does not give you the right to basically let your child die a horrible death from a disease, you know, that can be potentially cured.
Exactly. The other case I wanted to talk about, this one comes from Canada. This is an 11-year-old girl with leukemia. So this is the one with a 90% cure rate with standard therapy. Their courts are not letting her name out. But the extra wrinkle here is that the girl is a member of the Six Nations Aboriginal community in Canada. And so now there's also issues not only of parental rights, but of the rights of this community, this historically oppressed community in Canada. And that just complicates things even further.
Well, yeah, I mean, you got the same sort of wrinkle of that in the Sarah Hershberger case with the Amish, you know, and it's like, you know, this insular community. Mm-hmm. As far as this child, you know, this Aboriginal child, I think there is some of their religion has to do with it too. And religion often comes into these cases. Yeah, and I could, and the whole cultural conflict and the oppressed, you know, the oppressed people. I'm not sure how you get around that. The only, you know, the guiding principle that I always go by is it's the child. You know, it's not about you. It's about the child.
I wanted to read here. So this is also, there's a court case. There hasn't been a ruling yet, but there have been some interesting statements coming out of the court case. So these are quotes from the judge, Justice Edward. It's not clear if he's playing devil's advocate or whatever here, but this is, it's interesting that he thought it was necessary to say the following. Even if we say there is not one child who has been cured of acute lymphoblastic leukemia by traditional methods, is that a reason to invoke child protection? Are we to second guess her and say, you know what, we don't care. Maybe First Nations culture doesn't require every child to be treated with chemotherapy and to survive for that culture to have value. It's very problematic. So, you know, if kids die, that's fine. It's like the ultimate expression of cultural relativism. And
it's also, I think, somewhat insulting. I mean, it's like, you know, like the great white man looking down on them. Few kids in this culture died for their beliefs. So what? You know, that's basically what he's saying.
It's hard not to take it that way. Yeah. So if some primitives died, you know, who are we to judge? Even though he is a judge. As you say, at the end of the day, it's that child who's going to die for political sensitivity and the cultural beliefs of their parents and all that stuff. You still have a child who's going to be dead when 90% chance they could have survived.
Right. And these are not pleasant deaths. Okay.
No,
you know,
yeah,
they're not.
Painful.
They're, you know, one, I wrote a post for Science-Based Medicine a long time ago that was the basic message of which, well, you know, there's this concept. A lot of these people who make these choices, and it's not the kids, just the kids, you know, adults who go for alternative medicine, you know, think this too, that, you know, they will have this nice, peaceful death if even if their alternative medicine fails, at least they'll be spared the toxic effects of chemotherapy and they'll have this nice, you know, ideal sounding death. Abraham Cherix had that idea, you know, basically, well, if it doesn't work, at least I'll go out
peacefully.
You know, peacefully.
Yeah.
No, it's like, you know, bowel obstruction, bleeding, pneumonia, you know.
It's worse than the chemotherapy.
Exactly. I think my final sentence was something along the lines of death from cancer is worse than chemotherapy, you know.
But I think that gets to the sort of final fact here, and that's distrust. That a lot of this stems from, and that's where, again, I lay that at the feet, mainly of alternative medicine proponents who are using distrust of mainstream medicine to essentially to sell their alternative medicine.
Oh, exactly. I mean, there was that study not too long ago about the various kinds of conspiracy theories about medicine that are out there that people believe, and it's a distressingly high number of people who believe them, like the ever famous one that there really is a cure for cancer out there. It's just that they are hiding it from you.
Yeah.
They don't want you to have it, you know, which is one of the dumbest ones ever, because anything that big, no one could keep it quiet, especially since everybody pretty much everybody has a relative with cancer at some time or another in their life.
All right. Well, David, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about this difficult topic. I know it's not the brightest topic to discuss, but I think it's very important for people to understand what's going on.
It's very important, and yes, it is depressing to think about, but it's also, I think, uplifting if you think about just how far we've come in cancer treatments just since, like the 50s and the 60s. I mean, especially for children's cancer, if there's one area of cancer where we've done really well, it's children's cancer. You could say, well, pancreatic cancer is still almost as deadly as it was, 40 years ago, but that's not true of children's cancer. We can save most children with cancer.
Right. That makes it all the more tragic. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Dave.
All right. Thank you.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. Three regular news items this week.
Hooray!
Are you all ready? Here we go. Item number one. In a study of 2,000 consecutive whole exome sequencing tests, in 25% of subjects, the testing resulted in a molecular diagnosis. Item number two, astronomers announced that they may have detected dark matter particles from the sun. And item number three, a recent study of American middle school students found that they have, on average, a higher degree of digital technology savvy than their middle school teachers. Evan, go first.
All right, 2,000 consecutive whole exome sequencing tests. Okay, 25% of the subjects, the testing resulted in a molecular diagnosis.
So I might as well just explain that to you.
Yeah.
Everyone's going to ask.
Oh, thank God. It's like another language.
My brain is still putting the puzzle together. Go
okay,
ahead.
So the exome is the part of the genome that actually codes for proteins. Okay. Oh. So it's like a whole genome sequencing, but you're just sequencing the genes and just the parts of the genes that get transcribed into proteins. Not the, all the other stuff, not the regulatory or the introns, nothing else, just the transcribed parts. And when I say it resulted in a molecular diagnosis, that means that they found a mutation that is associated with the disease. So it actually led to the diagnosis of a genetic illness.
Okay, when you say it like that, that's huge. That's significant, which leads me to believe it may not be true. The second one about astronomers announcing they may have detected dark matter particles from the sun. I think I can believe that. Of course, there's the may qualifier in there. And dark matter particles from the sun. That's interesting. I think that one's going to be correct. The last one, American middle school students have, on average, a higher degree of digital technology savvy than their middle school teachers. I have to start thinking about how old is your typical middle school teacher. Now, Rachel's 11. She's not quite in middle school yet. She's in sixth grade. She gets to middle school next year. I've met her teachers. She's got a couple of them that are kind of in their 30s, and a couple of them, I think, are, probably in their 50s and so. So they're kind of on the cusp. I mean, we're not talking about old fogies here who have no clue how to even, open an email or anything like that. So there may not be as big a gap there as one might think because they are teachers and not just students. They're smart, so they can figure this stuff out. That one's the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah. All right, the exome. 25% seems like that's the perfect number to make me not know. Any less or any more might have made it a little easier. 2,000 consecutive. I don't know what the purpose of consecutive is in this sentence.
They're not cherry picking.
They did
2,000 tests in a row.
Okay. No, you're right. That is actually valuable. Okay. Let's see. The dark matter particles from the sun. Yeah. The fact that you have the word may in there kind of makes me okay with it. But then I'm thinking, if somehow there's some nuclear process that creates these that we're not aware of, then why do we detect so much dark matter away from luminous objects? You'd think that there'd be a correlation with the stars themselves. So I'm not sure about that one. The middle school students. Yeah, that one's kind of a little dicey as well. My first reaction is that, sure, of course, these kids grew up with technology as an integral part of their lives. But I don't know what the average age is of the, these teachers. You know, if it's in the 30s, then I think they would be pretty savvy as well. You know, but as they start, if the average is older, then maybe not so much. All right. I'm going to go with the middle school ones. That's just, yeah, I'm just going to go with it.
Okay. Jay.
The one about the exome sequencing, that's really, really, really interesting. I just don't know that much about it to really put my nickel down on that. So dark matter particles from the sun. I was just under the impression that dark matter was everywhere in some degree. So if they're detecting it coming from the sun, like being ejected from the sun, that is really cool. This last one is the only one that I can actually talk on, and that is I have a couple of data points here. One of them is Bob's daughter. She is amazingly non-technologically savvy, and I always found that amazingly strange because that's not how I was growing up. That's not how any of us were growing up, and I don't think that's uncommon today. I really don't. I think that there isn't a huge desire for people to master the devices that they're using. If anything, the devices that we use, you know, the trend is to make them more simple and have less, you know, don't make me think design built in. So I could see that. I'm going to go with the guys and say that I think that one's the fiction. I think that it is likely that the teachers will be more savvy than the students.
And finally, Rebecca.
I agree that there is an age difference in technological savviness, but I think that it's pushed back every day. And so in order for this to be true, I think that the teachers would have to be an average age of, I mean, at least 65, at least. I'm just trying to think of like how old my parents are, because my mom, not very tech savvy, but I know so many teachers that are, well, my age, tons of middle school teachers. I can't imagine that there are enough 100-year-old teachers to make up for the average of my friends who are all currently teaching at the ancient age of 30-something and who are easily more technologically savvy than your average 12-year-old or what have you. So I'm going to go with the crew and say that one's the fiction.
Okay. We'll take these in order since you all seem to be in agreement. So we'll start with item number one. In a study of 2,000 consecutive whole exome sequencing tests in 25% of subjects, the testing resulted in a molecular diagnosis. You all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Yep.
Is it as significant as I think it is?
It's huge. That is. It's very significant. You know, the notion here is that we use this as a type of screening procedure. You know, you look at all the genes and you're looking for risk factors for unknown diseases, you know, previously undetected diseases, et cetera. And that this just becomes a standard part of a medical exam. It's kind of like taking a family history right now. It's routine to take a family medical history. You know, why do I care, you know, what your mother died from or whatever? Because that is a clue about your own risk factors, right? But I don't know for sure that you got the same genes that your mother did. It's just more likely that you did statistically. If both your parents died of heart disease, maybe you're at higher risk for heart disease. But this way, I could just look at your genes and I could tell exactly what you got. And I'll know what your risk factors are. Of course, we have to learn about how to relate all those genes to specific risks. But the researchers did, in addition to just looking at 2,000 people, they looked at their parents as well. And so they were able to see where the genes came from. And some surprising things came out of that as well. For example, 504 patients, or 25.2%, had a molecular diagnosis. They found at least one mutation that actually related to something specific that were not previously known in that person. And then, by the way, also this study was in mostly children. Their average age was 6. There were some adults in there as well. It wasn't exclusively in kids, but it was mainly in a pediatric population. I don't know if that affects the results or not. It's interesting to think about. So for those who had a Mendelian disease, what a Mendelian disease means is that if you inherit the gene, you get the disease. It's not a risk factor. It's not a multi-gene thing. It's like a one gene, one disease type of situation. Of those, Of the there were 520 of the 527 specific mutations that they found, 53.1% were autosomal dominant, 34.3% were autosomal recessive, 12.3% were X-linked, and 1 was mitochondrial. So there were actually quite a substantial number of the mutations were not found in the parents, which means that they were spontaneous new mutations for that individual. So they said about 87% of the autosomal dominant genes were spontaneous mutations. That's a lot. It's more than I would have guessed. 87% of those who had a single gene causing a disease, they didn't inherit it from either parent. They had a new mutation of themselves. And then there was something I didn't even know about. There were 5 cases of people who inherited 2 copies of a gene from 1 parent. So they had uniparental disomy. So in other words, they got 2 copies of a diseased gene from 1 parent. There were 5 cases out of the 2,000 patients. That's not as rare as I would have thought. Now the bad news is that very few led to an actual change in management. So even though we're identifying lots of genetic illnesses and predispositions, et cetera, only like a very tiny number, only a few individuals did it make a diagnosis that would itself be treated. In all the other cases, it didn't lead to a specific treatment. So that's definitely coming. We're really at the very beginning of that sort of genetic medicine. But I could certainly see in like 50 years, this will be, you know, have a huge dominant role in medical evaluation. All right, let's move on to number 2. Astronomers announce that they may have detected dark matter particles from the sun. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Yeah, baby.
Oh, all right, good job, guys.
No way.
Yeah, of course it's May because it's, you know, it's got to be vetted, right? Just like the cosmic background, yeah, the radiation and the mitochondria mutations, et cetera. So,
how to get in there?
Yeah, so these are astronomers from the European Space Agency. They were observing X-rays from the sun. Bob, have you heard about this? So the one of the candidates for dark matter are particles called axions. Axions have the characteristics that we think dark matter should have. They are very light, but they do have mass. They have no charge, and they interact very weakly with matter.
Mm.
So
sounds like neutrinos.
Sounds, yeah, but it's also a candidate for dark matter, right? Because they're dark.
Yeah.
They don't interact. They have some mass. So if there's a lot of it, you know, they'll have gravity. But the axions, however, would interact with the Earth's magnetic field to produce X-ray photons, right? They'd produce X-rays. So that's what the astronomers were detecting. They were trying to see if there was any excess X-ray signal coming from the sun that could represent axions interacting with the Earth's magnetic field. And they found it. So it's a little circumstantial, the evidence. It's not direct evidence. It's a sort of indirect evidence, but you know, it does fit that model. Not everyone is convinced. Other researchers looking at the data saying, it's too circumstantial. You can't really conclude from this data that it's coming from axions, that this confirms the existence of axions. It could be, you know, some other artifact in the measurement. And they did take care to rule out all other sources of X-rays, but, you know, that's only as good as how thorough you were in doing that. It's hard to make the argument based upon the lack of evidence, you know, that you've ruled out every other source. But they, as good as they have. So again, this is definitely the kind of thing that's going to have to get picked over and vetted and repeated, et cetera. But they did detect evidence of these particles, which is one of the candidates for dark matter. All right. All of this means that a recent study of American middle school students found that they have on average a higher degree of digital technology savvy than their middle school teachers is, of course, the fiction, because the reality is that they're way behind.
Aha.
Teachers have a much higher level of technical computer savvy. What's interesting is that there is this belief that children born in the digital age have a certain inherent advantage, that they, you know, that if you lived your entire life with computers and smartphones and social media, that you just have a sort of intuitive understanding and savvy with digital technology that older generations that learned it later would not have. But they found that that's basically not true. And that in fact, kids are falling way behind. And it's interesting because it really does match, as you, you know, Jay, as you said with our niece, Ashley, Bob's daughter, but my, same way with my daughters as well. They don't have anywhere near the digital savvy, the computer savvy that I have, for example.
Wait, Steve, the way I interpret it, Steve, is that they, it depends how you define savvy. I mean, sure, they can use like these latest apps and these utilities and some software that we may just don't have experience with. But when it comes to troubleshooting, you know, if there's a problem, to know how it all works together and what you should check in order to troubleshoot a problem and fix something, that is more lacking than, than you would expect.
Yeah, I agree, but that's not what they were looking at.
Okay, what were they looking at?
They weren't looking at how to troubleshoot your computer. They were looking, so this is what students are good at. They know how to use a word processor. They know how to search Google and they know how to use social media. And that's about it. What they don't know how to do is to use computers and use software creatively or for problem solving. That exactly mirrors my experience with my daughters in public school is that when, it's because the schools are actually not incorporating any more digital technology than they were 20 years ago. They really have made no progress. They are not teaching our kids how to use computer applications to do stuff. Just again, beyond doing a Google search and using a word processor. And then even there, I'm teaching my daughters far more than they're learning at school. They're not really like learning how to do a Google search, learning how to find information on the internet. They're being given assignments where they need to do that, but I don't really see a lot of instruction there. I'm basically teaching them how to use their word processor. Now, like I'm teaching them how to use, like just recently I was, gave Julia a lesson on how to use Audacity because she wanted to do something with it. And so I showed her how to use it, but she had no idea, you know, so they're just not using it for stuff. That's the bottom line. And their school, there's just, it's not, it has not been incorporated into the school. You know, they're not using, they're not learning how to, you know, use Photoshop or, you know, use digital tools in any creative way. Whereas teachers do use the technology. They do understand the technology a lot better. It's really a shame. You know, it really highlighted for me what I've kind of sensed. You know, it's like one of those things like, oh, I really got to knuckle down and really start teaching my daughters how to be more computer savvy. They are slowly progressing, but not nearly as much as I would have hoped. And, you know, I think it's something I'm going to have to spend more time on myself because they're really not getting it at school. They're really not, which is a shame.
That's pretty much exactly my experience with Rachel as well. Couldn't have put it better.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I'm detecting the same thing.
I think the part of the problem is that you're walking into a technology, you're born into a technology that's already very mature. It's a black box. It's just a completely mysterious black box, and they are learning how to use it like trained monkeys. They're learning about what button do I push to make what I need to have happen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they're not getting a real understanding of like more theory and how to use technology and what's actually happening. And when I try to go there with my daughter, sometimes their eyes glaze over. Like, can you just tell me what I need to do?
I know exactly, Steve. My observation is, you know how like you've over the years of being a computer user, like you've developed instincts. Like,
yeah,
I know when I'm supposed to reboot my computer, like a certain kind of problem crops up.
Yeah.
You know, go for the reboot, versus the probably hundreds of other things that I have to troubleshoot in my daily computer life where I have other solutions, lots of other solutions.
Using the computer as a tool of information and communication and creativity. There's so much untapped potential there. It's frustrating. All right. I'll get off my soapbox now. Jay.
Yeah, good.
All right. All right. I'm done. You ready? Jay, give us a quote.
This quote was sent in by a listener named Christian Haugen from Norway. And this is cool. It's a quote from a podcast called The Now Show. It's a British comedy podcast. And they came up with a very clever quote for you. And here it is. Having a minister of health that believes in homeopathy is like having a minister of transportation who believes in broomsticks.
That's perfect. Who said that?
Right? That is that's a quote from The Now Show.
Is there a host name or just the show itself?
That's all I got.
All right. So thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Doctor.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.